Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, so let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with the terrorism investigation in Boston that led to the fatal shooting of Osama Rahim during a confrontation with law enforcement officers.
Here's Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans.
I don't think anyone expected the reaction we were going to get out of him, and that's why we had the tragic turnout here.
But many unanswered questions remain, including this from Ron Sullivan, attorney for the Rahim family.
If, in fact, there was an illegal arrest, we simply don't know. It is something that we have to look at and that we have to investigate.
And then this reaction from Imam Abdullah Farouk.
I do feel personally they might approach him in a different way.
Joining us now to talk about the shooting of Osama Rahim and the rest of the week's top stories is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a Boston Globe columnist. Tom, good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Renee Loth. She's the editor of Architecture Boston magazine and a columnist for The Globe. Renee, great to have you back.
Thank you.
And nice let's jump right into this conversation about Osama Rahim. A lot of unanswered questions here. Tom, what strikes you about this case? What are you thinking about it?
What strikes me is that everyone likes to see this case through their own particular prism. And I think that a lot of people are really jumping to very quick conclusions. If you are inclined to think that the police are bad, then you think they were bad in this case. If you're inclined to think that Islam is bad, then you see this as homegrown terrorism. There's a couple of investigations going on. We have a video there that the public has yet to see. I'm really eager to see the investigations proceed forward and see some semblance of truth come out.
Yeah. And Renee, what about you? Do you agree with that? Still, it is early times.
That's right. Well, you know, it's never a good thing when a citizen is gunned down by police on the streets in a neighborhood of Boston. But, you know, this is a very fragile time for the city. We've just come off the death sentence verdict for Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. We're still sentencing his friends and accomplices. You know, so it's just really not responsible to be making inflammatory statements, which I, you know, you understand and grieve for the family, along with the family, but I feel that some of the statements that the family's been making, although I think they've dialed back quite a bit on that in the last day or two initially, were quite unhelpful.
Hmm. Among the questions, though, I mean, I agree with you, Tom, first of all, but I still can't help. I mean, one of the questions that I want to have an answer to is, I mean, I'm very sympathetic of the apparent situation that these law enforcement officers faced, but I do wonder why there were so few law officers there if they thought they were confronting someone who was so potentially dangerous, and apparently they knew that.
Right. And I can't answer that question. Yeah. I mean, there were FBI agents, there were Boston police there. I think that they thought they were going to be asking him to questioning him, that they felt something might occur and they wanted to arrest him. I don't think, as Commissioner Evans said, I don't think they expected the reaction they were going to get.
Yeah. Well, we spoke yesterday with Bruce Hoffman. He's director at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University about this story. Here's an interesting point that he made.
There's a very fine line between someone having extremist views and then crossing that line and not necessarily even engaging in an act of violence that's terrorism, but plotting or planning or conspiring to engage in such violence. And this is, I think, why the authorities that we've given to the FBI and other law enforcement give law enforcement the ability, as at least newspaper and media accounts suggest was in this case, to listen in on people that are plotting and planning and conspiring to commit terrorist attacks.
So, Renee, the question that I have out of that is obviously big debate in Washington about giving the government powers of surveillance and stuff. Do you think this case is going to, or how do you think this case is going to contribute to that conversation?
Well, you know, I read the arrest affidavit for the nephew of Rahim, and, you know, they have transcripts of the recorded phone conversations in there. And, you know, it's not, you know, a completely open and shut case, but it's really valuable information that will help, you know, clarify this whole situation. So, you know, I have concerns about overweening government authority, absolutely. But I think in this case, we may be happy we have this information.
Well, those transcripts included them allegedly saying that, or Rahim saying he was planning to, quote, go after quote, the boys in blue. But, you know, the other aspect of this story, which was, you know, really interesting, is that some media outlets, CNN, The New York Times, are citing an unnamed law enforcement officer or source who says that Rahim was radicalized by ISIS through social media. Mm. And, of course, if that's true, the question of monitoring and how people are identified and how threats are assessed, that big question sort of comes right back to the fore. And Congressman Bill Keating, member of the House Committee on Homeland Security, he's been briefed on the investigation, as the Globe reported. He spoke with WBUR's Bob Oakes this morning on our air, and here's what he said about really the complex nature of the threats we face.
There's some indication in this case that the social networking went dark, meaning that encryption was used. Fortunately, in this case, there was already developed evidence to follow. There will be a case, I believe, that they're getting an active investigation of someone that is a suspect and very close to action. It could go dark because of the encryption, and they won't have the other evidence to follow as they do in this case.
So, Tom, let me ask you, I mean, we don't know exactly, obviously, what happened, but the question of the, you know, quote-unquote lone wolves being radicalized by social media, whether or not they have any direct contact with groups like ISIS, now seems to be really a pressing one.
Yeah, it is. And this is actually a really big social media issue anyway. The lone wolf phenomenon certainly isn't confined to terrorists, but to sometimes people who just, you know, have very extreme views on whatever is subject and always think that they're alone or used to think they're alone, and now all of a sudden can find some broad community. And whether it's terrorism or people who might be child abusers, you are now seeing people develop these kinds of networks. And yeah, it's a huge concern that we now have with social media, the real one of the big downsides to social media.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to a story from Capitol Hill. This involves Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren versus Mary Jo White, chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Warren sent a scathing letter, 13 pages, criticizing White's leadership, saying, "I am disappointed that you have not been the strong leader that many hope for." She accused Mary Jo White of lying. And what Warren says, White broke promises to institute a number of financial rules and regulations. And we can get into to what those are if we need to. The White House shot back. President Obama, big supporter of Mary Jo White, said when she was being confirmed, "You don't mess with Mary Jo White." But Renee, what do you make of Warren's letter and this challenge to Mary Jo White?
Well, I think that there's been some blowback, you know, from the White House and other supporters of the SEC, including, of course, Republicans who are happy to leap upon this. But you know, I think the main point that Warren was making is that the SEC director and the SEC has been slow to implement the requirements of the Dodd-Frank financial mm-hmm. disclosure law, which is, you know, Elizabeth Warren's signature achievement. And I think it's true. I mean, the law passed in 2011. I think it took effect in 2012. And, you know, still we do not have some of the requirements that, you know, that the law recommends. For example, an accounting of all of the CEO pay and the ratio between the top you know, salaries and the average of the workers in that firm.
Right.
And, you know, just this week we had a shareholders at the Vertex Pharmaceutical Company voted against a executive compensation package. It was only an advisory vote, so it probably won't take effect, but saying that the gap between the average biochemist and the CEO was just too wide. It was something like 370 times the salary. And this is the kind of thing that the kind of disclosure that the Dodd-Frank law called for that has not yet been created, and that is one of the examples of what Elizabeth Warren's talking about.
Yeah, another example was she said the SEC has settled in a vast majority of cases without the companies admitting guilt. This really sticks in her craw. But Tom, this isn't the first time that she's been at odds with Obama lately. Do you think that, I don't know, it seems like there's a bit of a backlash. Does it suggest that Warren's push for tougher financial regulations is losing momentum?
So Politico magazine had a piece titled basically, "Has Elizabeth Warren Finally Gone Too Far?"
Yeah.
And I think the answer is that if you felt she had gone too far already, then yes. And if you don't think she had gone too far, then you're really loving this. I think that Elizabeth Warren has a very large game plan here, and this is simply part of it. And her game plan is to change the conversation about politics and inequality and concentration of wealth in America. And for people who think that that conversation needs to change, this is exactly right. She is not looking for specific results in terms of trying to, does she get Mary Jo fired or not? She's trying to change the conversation for the next presidential election. You see that happening with some people who are entering into the race, like O'Malley and Bernie Sanders. But obviously, the real person this is aimed at is Hillary Clinton herself.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you a question about that, because changing the conversation is one thing, and as we're heading into a presidential election cycle, that's pretty powerful. But what about, the risk that Warren runs in alienating President Obama, also members of the party, on Capitol Hill by continuously pushing all this? Because, well, you know, what if potential legislation comes around? I know it's a fantasy, but then that could be, you know, regarding financial reform again. Like, could she lose allies by being the constant firebrand on this?
I think her problem with the sort of more mainstream of the Democratic Party is the concern that she is pushing the party too far to the left in a presidential year to come, and will make the eventual nominee of the Democratic Party more difficult to elect in November. The Republican side, the eventual Democratic nominee, more difficult to elect. And the Republicans have this problem, too. I think that the American people, by and large, regardless of party, are feeling that there's just too much corruption in our politics. That and we need some of the reforms that Warren has been calling for.
Hmm. Well, let's turn to another big story this week, whose capstone came not that long ago, and can be described like this.
This isn't the Rembrandt we're looking for, is it?
In fact, it is the Rembrandt we're looking for. That's Conservation Officer Lauren Schott, who found the missing Rembrandt and Dürer prints at the Boston Public Library. The two prints were found yesterday, just 80 feet away from where they were supposed to have been filed. Now, BPL President Amy Ryan said that the discovery does not change her decision to step down next month. Obviously, she was under an enormous amount of pressure while the prints were missing. So, Tom, let's just start with you. I mean, kind of almost a Sherlockian turn of events, if I can say, for these prints. But what do you think Amy Ryan should reconsider her decision to not come back to the BPL?
So I would hope she would. I think that she was a victim of something we were talking about earlier, a rush to judgment.
Exactly.
We don't let things play out. I don't know what agendas were really at play here in terms of Amy Ryan. By all accounts, she was a terrific head of the library. I don't think that she should be leaving. If there would be a way for her to reconsider that, I think that would be a good thing for the city.
Mm, Renee?
Yeah, I think, you called it Sherlockian, and I think that it is an unbelievably cruel twist of fate that this, these missing prints would be found misfiled, as Amy Ryan always said she sort of thought and hoped that they were, the day after she announces her resignation. It's really more like an O. Henry story, right?
Yes. It's
just, this is somebody who's a terrific public servant, and it's just a shame that she, should have to leave this position. The library is without a leader now. I mean, how are we going to even succeed in going forward with these plans now to finally catalog and care for these treasures that Boston has? These are the birthright of the people of Boston, these treasures, and frankly, it will take millions of dollars to properly care for them and catalog them, and I don't necessarily see a budget forthcoming from Mayor Walsh to achieve that.
Right.
So I really feel it's really a shame that Amy Ryan had got caught in the crossfire here, and I'm hoping that that she would reconsider.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine. I mean, I guess I'm trying to put myself in her shoes, and perhaps she just doesn't feel like she has the support,
right,
of key people that she needs amongst the board and other BPL leadership.
Yeah, well, the board
leadership
was very supportive.
But they were.
The political leadership of the city.
Of the city, in fact. And here's, we have some tape of Library Board of Trustees Chair Jeffrey Rudman.
I think losing President Ryan is not the best thing by any means that could happen to this library. Is she perfect? I don't know. Perfection is not a standard to which mortals can aspire.
So, I mean, Tom, it's an excellent point, but I come back to what you were saying about rush to judgment. And to me, that is like the big lesson here, that what do we, you know, city leadership, the media, gain by wanting to, you know, pillory someone ASAP when we, by all the information that we had, these prints had been missing for a while, and yet there was still this, like, convulsion across the city to find
right.
somebody.
It's a natural human inclination, which is we always want to blame somebody. And when some of these prints are allegedly stolen, we don't just want to blame the thief. We really want to blame the guardian as well. And that is apparently what happened here. But it's a phenomenon we see everywhere. You know, public servants in particular will find that some minor thing happens and gets blown up in the press, and all of a sudden their jobs are on the line.
I mean, not to say that we shouldn't believe in accountability, but perhaps a more measured pace of that accountability.
Well, the question is the leader actually instituting a system designed to promote accountability? But if what you do is simply take every slip-up and use that as an excuse to oust someone, then you really don't create a system for accountability.
I'm wondering if this is really over, this story. I mean, because I understand that the criminal investigation is proceeding. Mm. In other words, are we waiting for another shoe to drop? I don't know.
Well, there's the theory out there that, you know, the thief, if there was one, returned
right.
it. Because,
right.
of course, everyone's looking to make sure something doesn't go out of the library, but they don't care what comes in.
Yeah.
But that is a conspiracy theory that I'm not going to subscribe to.
Right. Well, let's move on really quickly and just talk very quickly. We just have a minute or two to do this about Governor Baker. He unveiled a plan to get the MBTA ready for next winter. New track heaters, anti-icing equipment, and replacing third rails. True to his word, the $83 million plan does not rely on new revenues. Meanwhile, of course, he's still pursuing his plan for a temporary control board to oversee finances and management of the T. And here's Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollock, who we spoke to earlier this week.
This is just a down payment on the kinds of changes that we're going to be needing to make at the MBTA and the kinds of investments that we're going to be needing to make in the system. This is not going to fix the T.
So additional funding to prepare for next winter, management changes. Tom, does it look like the Baker administration is going down the right track to get this T back on track?
I think the Baker administration has no choice. Okay, you're allowed. This year is a free pass for them because they weren't the ones responsible. Next year, they're not allowed the same free pass. Charlie Baker, as we've discussed on this show before, has amazingly high public approval ratings. I think that this is probably going to keep him very near the top. I think he's crossing his fingers and hoping some of these repairs, combined with a hope for milder winter,
I was going to say,
yeah,
is going to make,
exactly.
is
milder
make
winter.
For smooth moving.
Yeah, I just want to say that I don't think that having a year that's not as bad as this past winter should be the standard. Okay, because you know it was a complete meltdown, and you know the T is a public good; it has to be subsidized by the taxpayers. You know, despite what Charlie Baker continues to say, it is a revenue problem. And, you know, if the service doesn't improve, I was on the T just Wednesday night, beautiful, you know, early summer day, and there was no snow, and the service was terrible. And it's just, you know, the glorious economic, you know, recovery that everybody is so excited about in Massachusetts and Boston will just be choked off if this service can't improve.
Right. And by the way, that's a really important point. I mean, I think the real truth is that the set of storms like what we had last winter, no system could have handled that. It was just, as I understand, it takes at least a week to clear the tracks. We didn't have that amount of time between the storms. The real issue is what service like for the most of the normal days,
right.
And it really isn't up to par.
Definitely not great, for sure. Well, we've got just a little bit of time left for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that fell below the fold, but nevertheless caught our attention. So, Renee, let's start with you. What's your hubbub?
Yeah, this is sort of in the who knew department. Did you know that Boston has a city archaeologist? His name is Joseph Bagley, and he is right now conducting an archaeological dig on School Street in front of the old City Hall building,
yep.
where the It used to be Maison Robert. I think now it's a Ruth Chris Steakhouse or some damn thing.
There's anything wrong with that.
The lawn in front of the Old City Hall building has never been built on since 1635, and it used to be the location of the old Boston Latin School, or the first Boston Latin School. So there's a real hope there that they will be able to unearth some great archaeological items that will become artifacts in the city's repository, which, believe it or not, has almost 1 million items.
Wow.
I say, move over, Cairo. we are the archaeological dig center of the universe.
Well, therefore,
you can go by there and see it.
Then the city needs its own museum to showcase all these things.
Exactly.
It's true, the 1 million items, and they're really unique for U.S. history. We need a museum.
Well, they're out there in West Roxbury in a place that nobody ever goes to.
Something
we could put them in the DPL, but they just go missing.
But then they would be returned.
We'd find them.
Your hubbub?
So this isn't below the fold because it hasn't even been on the pages yet, and that is that the Department of Labor came out with its new estimates for new job creation in May. 280,000 jobs were created in May, and that makes for 3 million jobs over the last year. And so, again, the thinking is, hey, the recovery has finally taken hold. Times are good. And yet, if you go below those numbers, you will see that yet again as well, the labor participation rate isn't all that great. People really aren't coming back into the workforce in the rate that you want them to. And even worse, wages still seem to be stagnating, and the productivity rate is actually down this particular quarter. So you have something that on the top line looks like great news, and yet the bottom line appears to be a case where we still have to wait for maybe next month.
Well, Anthony, your hubbub?
Okay, so my hubbub is Malcolm Gladwell versus hedge fund manager John Paulson. We've heard a little bit of reporting about this, but these tweets are so much fun. So for folks who don't know the background of this story, Harvard very happy about receiving the largest gift in university history from hedge fund manager John Paulson. He gave $400 million to the Harvard Business School. Malcolm Gladwell, who apparently doesn't tweet that often, he's a New Yorker writer and author of The Tipping Point, tweeted frequently about this. Here's one that he said. It came down to helping the poor or giving the world's richest university $400 million it doesn't need. Wise choice, John. Here's another one. Next up for John Paulson, volunteering at the Hermes store in Madison Avenue. Let's make this a truly world-class retail outlet. And probably his best was, if billionaires don't step up, Harvard will soon be down to its last $300 billion.
$30 billion.
Sorry. Yeah, okay. Now, in the interest of fairness, there's been some pushback here. Here's Daniel Gilbert, a psychology professor at Harvard, who accused Gladwell of cheap jokes and bad logic. He tweeted, "If you want to end poverty, research and education are the best investments." And Mark Anderson tweeted this. He's a venture capitalist. America's research universities are our wellspring of scientific progress and economic growth. Gift to them are moral virtues. Full stop. So, a hot debate. Launched there by Malcolm Gladwell.
Nothing like a Twitter battle. but speaking of battles, I think I'd like a little music to introduce my hubbub.
We do have coming in confirmed reports of nuclear detonations. My God. Our soldiers were right. Changes.
Okay. Now, maybe no one in this room knows, but I know that there are people out there who are listening who said, oh my gosh, that is the sound from Fallout 4.
Of course.
The video game. That's going to be released in a week or so. It's going to be a mega blockbuster. Fallout 4, post-apocalyptic game where I guess you have to save the world or something. I'm not much of a gamer myself, but it's set in Boston. Okay, so this is a big deal. This could be a gazillion-dollar video game, and you see Fenway Park, the USS Constitution, although the Constitution's like kitted out with some huge, massive guns. You see the Paul Revere statue. You see the Old North Church. You see all sorts of stuff, and so depending on this, everything's a Rorschach test, right? Because Tom, because depending on your perspective, some people love this, some people don't. And amongst those who don't, the head of the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau, who said, "I just don't understand why there's a market in depicting and then destroying Boston's treasures this way." Newsflash, Pat, it's a video game. But he said the freedoms of expression that Boston set in motion centuries ago allow the violence portrayed in this game to be even possible. How ironic is that? But maybe even more ironic, Brian LeMay of the Bostonian Society and the steward of the Old State House said, "We should be flattered that these are the kinds of icons that are significant enough to be destroyed in people's imaginations. The destruction might not be as meaningful if the structures were not as historic and beautiful." Oh. So, Fallout 4, set in Boston. Anyone who plays, let me know if it's worth blowing up the Old State House.
I was going to say, if you love it, blow it up. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and Boston Globe columnist. Thank you, Tom. Have a great weekend.
It's a pleasure.
And Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston Magazine and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, thank you.
It's always great. Thank you.
Well, stay with us because coming up, the latest National Cancer Conference and cutting-edge technology in the fight against cancer. We'll talk to two Dana-Farber doctors about what they've learned. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.